speakers. Is that okay? Okay. Oh, thank you. I wasn't sure who loaned it to us. Thank you very much. And thank you very much, Huber. That was a great presentation. And I'm growing old, too, and I so much prefer it to the only alternative. So, our next speaker today will be Pat Westhoff, and the paper will be given by he and his colleagues he'll introduce, entitled Biofuel Policies and Markets in an Uncertain World.
Actually, it's Seth Meyer.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Excuse me.
Right.
Seth Meyer. I'm sorry, Seth. Sorry about that.
That's okay. Thank you very much. I'm quite curious about our selection for this track. I think the scientists must have gotten together and thought it would be amusing to have an economist come up and give a presentation and then watch me equivocate as I go through my slides. You know, on the other hand, this. I'll give one opinion, then I'll give the exact opposite opinion. So I kind of reworked my slides a little bit to try and say, you guys are scientists. I will show you a bit about the policies that policymakers are struggling with when it comes to liquid biofuels, kind of motor fuel replacements, okay? So I'm an economist. Ask all the questions you want. Don't take offense if I use slightly inappropriate terms, because I probably will, okay? So you can correct me during the question and answer session. That's quite acceptable. Slides? Do I have to launch them myself?
Oh, yes, but I could help if you want.
No. Let's see.
Sorry about that.
No, I'm sorry. I thought they were... I guess I had a
name right here.
Oh, is it right here? All right. See, I've already embarrassed myself in front of the scientists.
No.
All right.
So sorry.
That's okay. As we were saying, I work at the Food and Agricultural Policy Research Institute. We do ag policy. That's what we do. And we get our funding from Congress, okay, in order to analyze ag policy and now energy policy. And for us, guarding our objectivity is very important. As a matter of fact, during debates, we've been cited by opposite sides of the argument. Again, the economist giving both sides of the argument. So we've been used in these debates for opposite sides to make specific points, and we guard that objectivity very closely. We used to do mostly ag policy. It was all revolved around ag policy, and now that we're bringing these two sectors together, we find ourselves increasingly involved in energy markets and how they affect ag markets and how ag markets are going to participate in the production of biofuels. Okay? Some of the key elements of motor fuel replacement that we'll discuss, and that these are the key elements in our biofuel policies as it stands in the United States now. Tax credits. This is money. These are tax credits given to the blenders of biofuels. So they are subsidized to purchase biofuels, blend it with gasoline and other and distillates, and send it off into the commercial marketplace. Okay, that's one policy we have in place. The other one is we have an offsetting tariff on the importation of these liquid biofuels. The argument is that when you subsidize the blenders, if you don't put a tariff in place, then you're subsidizing foreign production. That would be the argument put forth by those who want the tariff in place. So we have credits, the blenders, tariffs as a border against importation of biofuels, and they can come over that. It's just an amount that they must pay. And then we have a renewable fuel standard, which says this amount must be blended. So it puts a floor under the amount of biofuels we'll need to blend, and that is growing over time, okay? So these are the three basic policies, okay? And so in this, there are a lot of things that policymakers struggle with as they examine how we'll change or modify or implement these policies as we move forward. And here's where I start my equivocation already. This is the slide that you show if you want to say that the production of biofuels in the United States is having very little effect on food prices. You go in and you say, world grain use as a share, our use of grains to produce biofuels is very, very small. And by grains, for everyone here, it's wheat, rice, corn, it's all those types of grain, including the food grains. And so the argument is, this is very, very small. This is the slide you show if you say, well, the impact can't be large because the use is not large, okay? If you want to show the opposite effect, you show this slide, which is the change from 2005 to 2007 in uses. And you can see here that you can compare use by other countries, other uses, and you can compare that to the red bar, which is the change in our use for corn to produce ethanol. So you can say the marginal use over the last several years, that the biofuel use has been quite large as a marginal additional use. So this is the share of additional uses as we go forward. Okay? Now we'll do the same thing In the oil markets, and we'll say, well, how much are we contributing to the oil market by the production of biofuels? So you show the same small addition to motor fuel production in the oil markets as compared to ethanol. So you say it's quite small, okay? So it's not doing a big job of replacing motor fuel use. But then you go on and you also show the marginal argument here, and you say from 2006 to 2008, where were we getting our additional supplies? We're getting a million barrels per day from OPEC, nothing from non-OPEC, and then you can see this, you know, 700,000 barrels a day from biofuels, okay? So it's a large amount of the marginal production of the additional supplies over that same period. So this is one of the struggles we're trying to deal with is it's a marginal production and it's a marginal use of grain. And what effects is this having in the marketplace? Okay. So one of the concerns has been, well, it increases food prices. There's an increase in food prices, and people saw food price inflation, and they would like to tie that back to biofuel production. But when we look at the cost of food, and we look at what is the share of the cost of food that's actually coming at the farm gate there is that little yellow slice that's less than 20%. The majority of food costs come after the farm gate. So if we're having a large effect on food prices, it is still a small effect in the total, and there's a lot of other costs in food that come after the farm gate, that come after the production of grain, after the farmer sells that grain. Okay? So in that same vein, we can look at food price inflation. And what we can see is that we had some run-up in food price inflation. And if you interpret, this is the if you take this month and you compare it to last year, how much higher our food prices were than they were a year ago, okay? But as it's coming down, that's implying that food price inflation has slowed. And over the last four months, food price inflation has been flat. And yet we are still producing more biofuels, okay? So there's a lot of other moving parts here when it comes to food price inflation than simply the cost of the grain and the cost of the commodity. Of course, when we say our marketing bill that the share that's at the farm gate is quite small, that is not true for many other places in the rest of the world. In many developing countries, they are much closer to that raw food grain price. If you are eating primarily rice, then swings in the price of rice have a very large impact on your budget. And they are using a much larger share of their budget to purchase food. So in the developing world, these food prices, to the extent that our prices are transmitted into these countries, swings in prices may have a much larger effect on those poorer countries which are importing a large amount of food. Okay? So as you can see, I kind of showed you a bit of history, but when we look at world corn food and ethanol use, that we are expecting to use a larger share of this as we move forward. Those mandates are growing, and there'll be room for corn to compete in those mandates, and we'll produce additional biofuels. So it is going to become a reasonably significant share of corn use as we go forward. And so it's one of the things that the policymakers struggle with. And when we look explicitly at, we are the largest trader of corn in the world. We export the largest volume. We are the largest producer. So what we do in the corn market does matter. And so what I've comparing here is, our exports, the three other largest exporters on top of that, so you can see we're larger than the next four largest exporters, and our ethanol feed use is expected to exceed that amount as we go forward. So this is one of the things that policymakers struggle with, which is how are we affecting food prices? How are we affecting changes in land uses around the world by whatever biofuel policies we'll put in place? And this is the one of the things they struggle with. Okay? So, for the sake of time, I'm going to skip this one because I know we're running behind. But one of the things that we could see in this slide is that ethanol, we talked about this boom in ethanol in 2006. And this is largely a decision by some locations to switch from MTBE to ethanol as an additive in their fuel markets. They made a large shift, demand was increased very rapidly, but there was only a limited amount of ethanol capacity at that time. That meant that there were very large profits to ethanol producers during that period. And that's what we can see here in the red line. Profits to ethanol producers were very large because there was a policy shift from MTBE to ethanol in places like California. Profits were seen, lots and lots of people entered into the marketplace, we have lots and lots of capacity, profits are shrink quite substantially, and we find ourselves now where there are some plants that are closed. They're simply, they're being squeezed, profits are not large enough for some of them to run. There are other bad business decisions which push some of them out of the marketplace, but part of it is simply that we've got more capacity than we need to meet our mandate, and oil prices are below $50 a barrel. That means the mandate is supporting demand, but the mandate is not large enough to fully employ the ethanol capacity we have today. It grows, and so these plants will come back online as the mandate grows, but profits have been tightened up quite a bit now that we have a larger amount of capacity. Okay? One of the infrastructure issues that we deal with here is, what I'm showing you is motor gasoline use. On the left slide is motor gasoline use, and then how much ethanol use will be relative to that in the United States as we follow these mandates. Okay? It is still quite small, but if we look at the right, there is a volume, the by volume percentage shows you that we're quickly approaching 10%. And you know in Missouri, when you go to the pump, you're getting 10% blends. If you're purchasing gasoline at the pump, you're all purchasing 10% blends right now. Whether you know you are or not, you're purchasing 10% blends. So we will quickly get to the point where the mandate is growing so quickly that we will have to either change from 10% blends or quickly expand flex fuel uses. And this means infrastructure for dispensing flex fuels and vehicles which can use them. So this is an infrastructure problem that needs to be overcome, or we need to think about what are the alternatives of using higher than 10% blends in either existing fleets or in new cars which are not technically flex fuel cars. Okay? And so when we do this type of analysis, we look at what are the mandated uses. And these additive and mandatory uses are in places like California. So there's a specific amount of volume that national policies have very little to do with. They're often state policies, such as our Missouri state policy, which requires 10% blends. Then we have voluntary uses, where they're selling it at a price for which the people will buy it. And these uses will be quickly saturated, and as the mandates expand, that total kind of follows along, follows a little bit along with the mandate. We're going to have to find ways to use it. If we follow the mandates, we're going to have to use have flex fuel vehicles, flex fuel infrastructures, or come up with a way to use higher than 10% blends in existing fleets or new cars. Okay. So, I think I have a few minutes left, so I'll actually be able to spend just a few minutes on this one, because what I want to talk to you about is we have these policies. We have these policies of subsidies and then mandates. And so you think that these may be very redundant. We're going to pay you to do something, and then we're going to tell you have to do it. Okay? And in some ways, which policy is most important kind of depends on the context of things. And what I've got here is I took a look at low oil prices, and by low I'm saying $67 a barrel, or high oil prices above $100 a barrel. And then you have with and without the policies. So you can see in certain circumstances that when you have policies in place, it is very, which one is important depends on the oil price. If we have mandates in place and the oil price is very, very low, the oil price is not determining what's being consumed in the market. It's the government mandate which is determining how much is being consumed in the marketplace. So whatever subsidy we give people is largely irrelevant. Okay? But if oil prices are very, very high, above what the market wants to purchase more than the mandate, then the mandate is irrelevant. Then removing the mandate has no effect. Okay? So what you can see from this is when you raise, when you add the policies, that the policies have a larger effect, the mandates specifically, have a larger effect when oil prices are low than if they are high. And this affects both billion, on the left is ethanol production, and on the right is the price of corn. Okay? So which policy is important depends on context. Oil prices are high, it's the credits which have an effect. Oil prices are low, it is the mandates which are determining how much we're using. And so When you have two policies which seem to be doing the same thing, but it has very different effects depending upon the context. Okay? And that just wanted to give you an overview of the policies in place and the policy struggles that they're dealing with. And I'll take more detailed questions if you like, but I thought this was a way just to give you a flavor for the kind of policies that we actually deal with. We've got lots and lots of reports over these issues, but I thought it'd be better to give you just a flavor of what we do. Sure. I'm an economist, so as long as they don't mind if I equivocate, that's no problem. Okay.
On your ethanol projections and your ethanol graphs, are you talking about ethanol for all sources or just ethanol for corn?
No, from all sources. We have these underlying mandates, and these mandates are actually not, there is no corn ethanol mandate. There is no mandate that says we will produce this many gallons from corn. There is a slice for which they can compete. But there are other slices as well, too. There's a mandate, a total mandate. There is a mandate for cellulosic ethanol. There's a mandate for bio-based diesel ethanol. There's a mandate for advanced, which encompasses those, but could include things like sugar. And these other technologies, which you all deal with, can fit those niches. Okay? And you're likely to compete for those other niches, not the niche that corn tries to compete with, because by stratifying these, there's a higher price in some of these niches which are harder to achieve. Okay? You know, so it's likely that this part of these mandates that corn can compete will be largely filled by corn, because I think some of the technologies we're seeing evolve, algae and these other processes, cellulosic processes, have their own niche, which will be difficult to fill. So there'll be a lot of competition, but that's where they'll compete. I'm sorry.
No problem.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Do you have some charts maybe we can refer to later to see what percentage that was? You know, you initially get maybe 100 tons. There's probably, what, maybe 70 tons that's left still for feedstock?
Well, you start out, a bushel of corn is 56 pounds. You get 17 pounds of what are called distiller's grains out of the other end. And that's it's a nice quality feed. And there are other things that you can do, too. The scientists can split the corn up into bits and pieces. They can produce corn ethanol from starch. Part of it they can take and produce cellulosic ethanol, which can fit one of the other mandates. But you start out with 56 pounds, and you end up with about 17 pounds of distiller's grains, which substitutes for both corn and some soybean meal in animal feeds. So it doesn't, the whole bushel of corn doesn't disappear. Did somebody else have a, yes? Well, as I said, the stated purpose is if we're going to subsidize the blenders, then we need an offsetting tariff so we're not subsidizing foreign production of biofuels. So if we simply eliminated the tariff, the argument would be we've got this blender subsidy which allows them to pay more for the biofuel, which would essentially subsidize foreign production of biofuels. That's the argument. The cost of sugarcane ethanol in the world market is lower. I mean, but if we started importing a bunch, we would drive up the price of that a bit as well, too. There's some discussion about moving this credit away from the blenders and giving it straight to the producers, in which case you could also eliminate the tariff. The argument is that it's an offsetting, the tariff is offsetting whatever subsidy we're giving to the blenders. That's the argument. But sugarcane ethanol is very efficient, this is largely a policy decision. There are reasons for that tariff to exist, and people have it for different reasons for wanting to keep it in place.
We have a question.
Oh, sorry.
Yes, Missouri's ethanol mandate does have a circuit break.
Sure. Yes.
Have you seen continued use of ethanol despite the circuit trip, or what's been the pattern?
That's right, and I should have been careful, because right now I don't know what we have a 10% blend mandate, but there is a trigger that says if in Missouri ethanol is too expensive, you don't have to use it. It's a consumer protection trigger, and so I should be careful, because right now I don't know if we are in that 10%, if they're in the range or not, and if you're getting the blends or not. So I need to be careful about that. But this is a In Missouri, if the cost of ethanol is sufficiently high to protect the consumers, the mandate is waived. And so that's why you may see some odd pricing between 87 octane and 89 octane when you go to the pump, because sometimes they're 10% blends, sometimes they're not, sometimes gasoline is cheaper, and so that's why you'll see the 89 and 87 octanes bouncing around. But there is a consumer protection trigger within our state mandates.
Very good. Thank you very much. I'm sorry we didn't have an opportunity to. Well, thank you very much. And again, sorry we didn't have the opportunity to get to all the questions, but I encourage people to speak with the speakers after the session if